I'd like now to introduce our guest speaker of the month of March, and she will be speaking tonight on steps 6, 7, 8, and 9, and that would be Carrie C. from Harrison, New Jersey.
Hi, I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes, you are.
You're lucky you didn't know me when I was drinking, Mike. I was worse. 6, 7, 8, and 9. You know, when I look at 6 and 7, you know, there's only a couple paragraphs in the big book about 6 and 7, and I used to think that there wasn't a lot to it because the big book didn't devote a lot of time to it. And then I realized that every page before that was devoted to 6 and 7, that every page of the big book talked about my inability to control my own character defects and my powerlessness over myself. So therefore, every paragraph and every page and every sentence and every word is about 6 and 7. That's why Bill only had to dedicate a few paragraphs to it, because he said it already. I didn't realize that when I first started going through the steps, actually the first few times through the steps. I really thought 6 and 7 was a matter of realizing that self-sufficiency, verbalizing, let's get that correctly, that self-sufficiency, and that whole, like, you know, control freak thing and then the actor and all that wonderful stuff wasn't working. And then, you know, saying that seven-step prayer. And I didn't really comprehend what 6 and 7 was all about. You know, and again, you know, what I've been speaking about and one of the great things about this meeting, because you don't have the book in front of you and it's not about mechanics and it's not about the details, but more about the essence of the steps. You know, that's what, you know, 6 and 7, there's a very powerful essence to that. And I didn't experience that essence my first time through the steps. I mean, I did. I know that I cried when I said the seven-step prayer. I mean, I cried through my fifth step because I felt so powerless. I felt the impact of who I had been and what I had done. You know, but as I had gone through the steps after that a handful of times, it had less meaning until I had a very, very powerful spiritual experience with 6 and 7. Something akin to a white light experience. I kind of believe that whole, like, you know, powerful spiritual experience, white light, you know, thing that they talk about in the big book and that Bill talked about and was mentioned in some of the history literature was like a fable or a myth. And at first, like, I expected to have one and it didn't happen, so then I thought there was something wrong with me. Because there's always something wrong with me. And then I was like, God doesn't think I'm special because I don't get to have this really big spiritual experience. I have that educational growing, you know, sort of thing. And I thought that kind of sucked because I couldn't say, look, I had this fantastic spiritual experience. Because that's what I really wanted. I wanted to go to a meeting and say, I had a spiritual experience. Not only had I had a spiritual awakening, but, you know, I had a white light experience. I didn't have that. But what happened was is that when I was ready to have that spiritual experience, it happened. It was when I stopped needing it to validate that God loved me. And it always happens for me. Do you ever notice that? Like, you know, it was for me in second grade, the boy that I really liked and that I wanted to notice me, I would just will him to notice me. And then he ignored me or he pulled my hair. And then the minute I stopped caring about him, he would follow me home. I mean, that's kind of the way it is in life. Anytime I have a demand, I don't get it. That's the bottom line. If I have an agenda, you know, I mean, I love John Steinbeck, you know, and he was one of my favorite writers. And, you know, he always says that, you know, what is it? The plans of mice of men often go astray. And I remember reading that, like, you know, ninth grade English class, thinking, oh, yeah. You know, that's my entire life. I have a plan, and it never happens. And why? And then when I stop planning and I'm honest about my motives and desires, these things happen. They're gifts. They become pearls because they're not expectations. I don't take them for granted. So, you know, after having gone through the steps a handful of times, and, you know, I think it was like my 6 year of sobriety, I had a spiritual experience with the 6 and 7 step. And I was alone, so I couldn't prove it. And it was at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and it was just one of those things, you know. I had done a group fifth step. I mean, I had done the long form. I don't know if anybody knows what long form is. It's a really long four step, and it's kind of like Yeah, it's really anal. It's very cleansing. you don't want to have a lot of resentments when you do that inventory because it'll take you forever. Essentially, what it is you write out your third column and you find the selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonesty, and fear associated with each one of the seven areas of self. So it kind of ends up being like 37, 38 columns, kind of, subcolumns, 30, yeah, something like that, you know, 35 subcolumns. It's no fun. But I needed something drastic in my sobriety. I needed to get gut level honest, and this was something that was suggested to me to do, and my little ego loved it because all the guys did it. None of the girls did it, so I had to do this inventory because, you know, the boys did it, and, you know, and the women weren't handing this out, and it was like this secret thing, so I did it. I think there was one other woman at that time who had done this inventory, and of course that so played on my ego. So I did this inventory, and I had all these expectations, and I was in a lot of pain. I was in a lot of pain when I did that inventory because, like, I had already had, like, 6 years of sobriety under my belt and been sponsoring quite a bit, and I was still so selfish. And I was still so superficial. It was pitiful. And I had discovered a personality called Little Miss AA. I didn't know she was in existence, but she kind of came up on that inventory. And I was kind of getting honest about, I had to get honest at that point about my role in Alcoholics Anonymous and my expectations, my ego. Bill, I was reading Stepping Stones to Sobriety or something like that, a Bill Pullman book, I don't know the name of it. I think it's Stepping Stones to Sobriety or something like that. I was reading today something about Bill wrote, and he said that basically there's a lot of schemers in Alcoholics Anonymous who use Alcoholics Anonymous for their own ego's ends. And that was me. I came into AA to get sober, and I used AA to scheme because I was an insecure little girl who wanted to feel superior. So in this inventory, I discovered this. It was not fun. And, I had, like, good motives, but underneath those good motives and in between those good motives and in between all that, I discovered that there was this line, you know, of kind of using AA to feel superior to others and, you know, all those people who don't work the steps, don't they know what AA is all about? I mean, I think a lot of people who get into the steps kind of fall into that scorn of what we think is fellowship AA. And then even among big book thumpers, the people who are the best kind of thumpers who are more fundamental than others, who know the book better and who has more sponsees, and it can get a little, it got a little cutthroat in my own little head. And so I did this inventory and I discovered that that's how I was relating to Alcoholics Anonymous, that on some level it stopped being about my not drinking. I stopped being about God. So I did this inventory, and I was like, oh, my God, what the hell am I going to do? I'm in trouble. You know, I kind of ease God out of the steps. That ain't good. So I did this inventory, and I went to a person who was kind of acting as my spiritual advisor at the time, and I said, what do I do with it? I'm in all this pain. I got to get rid of this thing. He said, find three newcomers who had just gone through the steps for the first time and tell them this. They have to be under a year. And I was like, hell no. And people you don't know, by the way. I'm like, hell no. You know, I'm like, I had 7 years of sobriety. Sorry. I had almost 7 years of sobriety, somewhere around there. And there was no way in hell that I was going to somebody with, you know, who was still on fire with the steps to hear about what an egomaniac I had become. I did do that, though. And I wound up doing a fifth step with four women. One of them had to leave in between, so then it became three because it got to be long. I'm a little winded, long-winded. It ended up being four women who had less than a year. One had a year and 2 months, and she was one that left. And they had all been through the steps and were on their ninth step. So they were feeling the first flush of God. And they're listening to this jaded witch who used AA to become, you know, supreme ruler of her universe. And the whole time, like, I was told that I was not allowed to justify, like, you know, hey, when you get to be 7 years sober, you'll do this stuff too. And I so wanted to. I wanted to stop in the middle of this inventory and be like, don't worry, you know, you're going to be as messed up as me in a couple years. I didn't, though. So I did this inventory, and it was in this fifth step, and it was in a diner, too, you know. And we stayed there. I got home at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, well, I got to take this quiet hour. And I timed it, man. Like, there was no, I was so bad. Like, I would be, like, sitting up looking at my watch, you know, be like, you know, I did 40 minutes of a quiet hour after a fifth step. And I was like, I got to get that 20 minutes in there. Big Book said an hour. So then I just stare at the wall. Like, no constructive anything. Falling asleep because I had just done a fifth step for a million years, you know. And you know, like, not, like, so rigid that I couldn't not give it an hour. Or, you know, whatever. So I came home and I had to do my quiet hour before I went to sleep at 2 o'clock in the morning. I had to do this, and I did. And what I did is I had to stay awake also. So I took my fourth step and I took everything in candles and I went into the bathroom into the tub because that's where I love, like, in the middle of the night with candles and bubbles and quiet. And I took this in there, and one of the things that I was always told to do with my fourth step after I had done a fifth step was go through it and highlight my character defects, like look at the patterns. Because it's one thing to write it, and it's another thing to talk about it, and there's another thing when you got to bring it back to God. And you're supposed, you know, I was told to reread my fourth step, you know, between me and God, and look at what's going on here. Look, you know, allow the light of God, the sunlight of God to come in through, and it happened. Like, it happened that way. The first time I had read my fourth step to God, I was like, all right. I read it out loud. This time, I didn't read it out loud, but I sat with it, and I sat with me and God, and I prayed. And this thing came to me. You know, I had this thought in my head, why don't I write a letter to God and ask him to take all my character defects, all the parts of me? Because I can't manage me. My relationships, I can't manage my relationships. You know, on some level, I still thought I was in charge of my relationships. I still thought I was in charge of my relationship with myself, with my husband, with my children, with, you know, my school, my work, my parents, my family, with the world, the law, everything. Like, I still thought that I was in charge of those relationships. They were my relationships. And you know, the whole idea, like, if M-Y or I or anything, it's usually it's a little dishonest there, you know, because I didn't look at the fact that I was God's child. When God was within me, and that in the second step proposition, if God is everything, then God is all of my relationships also, that they're not just mine, but they're an extension of God, and therefore, I'm not in control of them. And this whole thing came to me at 2 o'clock in the morning in a bubble tub with, you know, coffee and candles in order to stay awake because I had to do my hour. And so I wrote this letter to God, asking him to take every piece of me. And I can just remember, like, I don't even know if I did the whole hour after that point. It was so profound. And it sounds so crazy. It just thought just came to my head. And I was just sitting there. And it's something that I'm sure, you know, you guys have thought about 100 times before, but it was something that I hadn't truly surrendered, you know, in my life, was what I do. I wanted God to fix me, to make me behave better. But I wanted it so that, you know, things would go my way. Not so that I could be a better service. Not so that God would... I wanted that stuff because I didn't want the... I wanted God to fix me and take my character defects because I didn't want the consequences of them. Not because I wanted God to be a part of everything that I did. The fact is that I didn't want God a part of everything that I did because then I couldn't do some certain things that I wasn't unwilling to do. I didn't want God there. But after having done that fifth step and realized what me, self-will run riot me, using the 12 steps to my own ends, me, had done it to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, how I could take something so beautiful and so pure and pervert it in my own little head. You know, I felt the unmanageability of trying to run my own spiritual life. Can you imagine that? I tried to run my spirit. Jesus, what was I thinking there? You know, I mean, like, I wasn't, you know. Somehow, I still was playing God within my own little house in my head. And so I wrote this letter. I mean, I asked God to take the way that I perceived myself. That was one of my biggest things. I wore insecurity like a cloak. And, you know, I'm a recovering anorexic bulimic, and anorexia and bulimia were like an alcoholism and men, You know, like, I pretty much anything that would help me feel in control of me, I would do. You know, anything that I could do in order not to feel, I would do. It's all part of my spiritual illness. And those were areas, like, the way that I perceived myself, my own insecurities, I was not willing to give to God. And in that moment, in that brief, that humility that was I was graced with, not that I gave myself, I was able to see this. I looked at it, it was like this flare in a dark room. And it burned for a while, and it felt wonderful. And it burned out, you know, and it didn't go away, though. I mean, the experience of that, that experience of the seventh step and the sixth and seventh step with that, you know, when it says all, it doesn't mean, you know, some. It means all. I didn't get that. I thought it was all the things that got me in trouble. Not all of me, you know. Only the things that were inconvenient. God, to me, was still an ATM. You know, you walk up, you put in your card, you push your buttons, and you get your result. And I thought the steps worked that way. I thought they were a combination code in order to get what I wanted. The experience of the steps was something that eluded me for a long time. You know, I'm pretty sick. So, you know, I had this profound experience, you know, and I had had something, it was really weird because from my sixth and seventh, you know, and now my eighth year of sobriety have been the hardest years of sobriety in my life, the most humbling, and they were not by my choice, but because I would die and I would drink if I didn't do it. Or I didn't do it. God did it for me. God took things away from me. And it wasn't taking away like taking a toy away from a child for me. It was I recognized that things in my life were unmanageable, and I asked God, how? Help me here. And God pared down my life. You know, at one point, I was in school full time, 2 children, a marriage, and 13 sponsees. And I'm 26 years old. So, like, it's not even like I have emotional maturity on my side here. I don't, you know. I'm still 26 years old, man, you know. So, you know, and I said to God at some point, I was like, my life is unmanageable. God, I can't be everything to everybody. I can't do this, God. What do? Everybody fired me but 5. And it stuck, too. Some of them were just like, you know, Karen, I need a new sponsor. You're great. I love you. And other ones were like, you failed me. To the road. And I had to sit quietly with that. You know what? I did. I failed you because I'm not the sponsor for you, and that's okay. And I had to suck that one up and not defend it. That was freaking hard. Be like, yes, I didn't fail you for 2 years. It's only been lately. I'm busy, you know. But, you know, but the thing is that when that moment happened and that experience, that knowledge, that grace that I was given, to that insight into my life that I was given, although, you know, it's not that it dimmed. You know, there's this book, it's called After the Ecstasy, Then the Laundry. Okay, you guys know about it. You know, they talk about that spiritual experience, and they talk about what happens after it. You know, what happens after you have, you know, several profound spiritual experiences? How do you fit this new awakened spirit into, like, mundane, everyday American life? It's kind of hard, you know. I don't get to go into a cave. I don't wear saffron robes. I got to, you know, wipe my children's nose, and my sponsees call me at odd hours, and school sucks, and I can never get parking, and I get tickets all the time, and, you know, stuff happens. You know, don't have money, then I have money, then I don't have money, everybody wants money, you know. you know, it's, you know, all part of life. You know, I don't get to hide out in a little cave, you know, and levitate and whatever. You know, I gotta show up. I wanted to, man. I'm like, dude, you know, that's it. I'm gonna commit myself to, like, some sort of monastery or something, or, like, you know, I'm just going to Tibet. Screw this. Well, not Tibet, because, you know, Tibet's kind of controlled. But never mind. There's a bad political situation there, but you get my drift. You know, I'm going to Nepal. Whatever. Whatever. The fact is that I'm running away. You know, let me take my awakened spirit, not share it, but go hide it so you people don't mess with it. You know, and I couldn't do that. So what happened was that I had this wonderful spiritual experience, and it stays with me. It really did for a long time. And I mean, it's like I was in this amazing place. I felt like I had Teflon on me. That the problems and the frustrations and the fears and all these things didn't really stick to me the way they had before. I didn't carry them the way they did. You know, and today, some of them stick, some of them don't. And when they do stick, I'm able to recognize them. And then, you know, something in that surrender that happened in that moment resurfaces itself and it slides off. You know, I have financial insecurity, you know, like I'm being audited by the IRS for a couple years back. We filed our taxes wrong, our stupidity. They say we owe them money, and we say we don't, and it's okay. You know, these things happen in my life, but they're not crises. And that's all part of that spiritual experience, the extension of the seventh step. Because God is in that relationship too. God is in my relationship with the IRS. God is in my relationship to money. God is in my relationship to my material possessions. They're all extensions of God for me. You know, and I forget that and I remember it. And that's all part of the seventh step for me. You know, and the last little bit I'm going to say on the sixth and seventh step. You know, I had started off saying that, you know, there's only a couple paragraphs. I think it's two or three paragraphs in the big book about six and seven because the whole book is about six and seven. And I at one time, like this had come to me. I was going through the big book with a sponsee, and you know, sometimes, most of the time, the greatest spiritual insights I ever got were when I'm sitting across my kitchen table with another person. Somehow, God working through the two of us helps to illuminate God's universe for me. So I was sitting reading this, you know, going through the fourth step, and you know, I came across this whole thing about, you know, us being so powerless over selfishness. And I thought, you know, I never really thought that I was powerless over selfishness. I mean, it said I was powerless over selfishness, but that wasn't something that I had internalized. I still thought on some level that if I played right and I played with a nice little girl and I did what I was supposed to do, that, you know, it would just go away. Like, I didn't really comprehend that I was as powerless over selfishness as I was over alcohol. And I said this before. And fear, and resentment. You know, so it. And what happened is I saw that sentence, and it struck me. It said that I was as powerless over selfishness and resentment as I was over alcohol, and that God was the only thing that could relieve me of these things. And I said, you know, I saw that echoed somewhere else in the book. You know, the book echoes itself 1,000 times, and I love that because alcoholics are dense. It don't take me reading 60 pages for me to see what Bill said 30 times before. You know, excuse my French, but it's like throwing shit at a wall. Some of it stinks, sticks, some of it doesn't. Sorry. See, that's the whole 26 thing, you know. We get to curse. We're kids. Anyway, you know, that's kind of how Bill did it, you know. And for me, I saw that sentence and I said, you know, where else in the book did it say something about me being powerless over, you know, my own moral convictions and such and my philosophical convictions and all of that wonderful stuff? And I realized from We Agnostics on, you know, Bill says that, you know, that moral conviction, we can have moral convictions galore, but we can't live up to them as much as we would try. I can't live up to them as much as I could try because lack of power is my dilemma. And so for me, the crux of the seventh step lies in the second step. Because my problem isn't that I'm allergic to alcohol. I am. My problem isn't that I'm obsessed with alcohol. I had been. And I can be again. My problem is that I lack power. That's the bottom line. Lack of power is my dilemma. That's my problem. Dilemma, problem. Problem, dilemma. And my powerlessness over alcohol, my powerlessness over my moral and philosophical convictions, my powerlessness over my selfishness, resentment, and fear, my powerlessness over you, that whole thing about the actor and trying to control people, my powerlessness over just about everything in this darn world, you know, lack of power is my dilemma. And so what's my dilemma with lack of power? You know, do non-alcoholics have more power than I do? Or is it my delusion that I have power is my dilemma? Something to consider. You know, are non-alcoholics more in control of their selfishness than myself? I've seen some pretty selfish non-alcoholics, and I've seen selfishness wreck a lot of different people on a lot of different levels. Are they more power? Do they have more power over selfishness than I do? I don't know. Is it my delusion? You know, Bill talks about us wanting to cure the headache with the hammer. He wasn't just talking about alcohol, guys. He was talking about me use my brain to fix my brain. That doesn't work. Using my will to fix my will does not work. Using my spirit to fix my spirit does not work. That equation does not work. You know? So when he talks about me trying to fix myself with myself without divine intervention, without the grace of God, without going to the higher self or the highest self or God within, God without, or wherever the heck you find God, or I find God, and I use myself to fix myself is my problem. So, for me, you know, I'm not really sure whether it's my own powerlessness over myself that is my dilemma or my delusion that I have power. I'm still waiting for some answer on that one. And maybe I'll get some intelligence a couple years down the road, or maybe I won't. Maybe it's something that I just need to watch and wait for. That's what's so awesome about having a spiritual experience is watching and waiting. You know, good example. We're talking about the eighth and ninth step now. I was sitting with a sponsee today, and we were considering whether or not she had to make amends about something. And I said, well, go make this amends and watch and wait in your relationships. Watch how you interact with these people at work and ask yourself whether you need to make amends. So for me, after having had a spiritual awakening, as a result of these steps, and trying to live basing my life or aligning my will with God's, a lot of it's watching and waiting and asking God for the grace, asking for the insight and being quiet. You know, that's why, 10 and 11 is so gosh darn important. So when I have this experience and I realize how powerless I am over my own relationship with myself, God, and everything else in this gosh darn world, when I have this experience and I look at 8 and 9, I got to go out and make an amends for, my delusion that I can control myself and my inability to go to something greater than myself in order to help me be of service. And the one thing that I love about the ninth step, it says that we fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and others. I had been waiting for everybody else to change so that I would be a better person. So that if everybody else did what I wanted them to do or acted the way I thought they should, then I wouldn't have to be so damn selfish and I wouldn't have to get so many resentments and I wouldn't be so gosh darn threatened. And in the ninth step, it says that we fit ourselves to be of maximum service. And pretty much it begins with that. I believe it's like maybe the second page in, right at the top. It says we fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and others. That's the spirit that I bring into the ninth step. That spirit when I realize that it's not about everybody else changing so that I can be better, but me surrendering all of my shortcomings and all of my successes to God so that I can be shaped and fit to be of maximum service to God. So, let's see, the eighth step. Let's see, does eighth step have all in it? Oh, it does. It said, made a list of all persons we have harmed and came willing to make amends to them all. And I harp on all a lot. It doesn't say make amends to them all. Let me clarify. It said became willing. Nine steps says whenever possible. There's a big difference between being willing to make amends to them all and actually going out and making amends to them all. That's where a sponsor comes in. God, meditation, watching and waiting. That's really important in 8 and 9. That's why, in the 10th step it says, as we cleaned up the wreckage of our past, we watch, wait, and listen. I changed that a little bit, but, that we, as we clean up the wreckage of our past, we continue to take personal inventory and set right any mistakes as we go along. So in 8 and 9, I'm supposed to have been getting some sort of a relationship with God, and it's a lot different than a telephone. Hey, God, I'm in trouble, 911. Hey, want some info, 411. It has to be something more than that. It's got to be reciprocal. And I needed to start developing that before I got to 8 and 9. And I'm not telling you not to do 8 and 9 until you have that. That's kind of the point. It happens because you go out and do that stuff. You know, in the big book it says that when we straighten out spiritually, that we straighten out both mentally and physically. And that's kind of the same concept that we bring into the 8 and 9 step. That we go out to set right the wrongs that we have done to the world. We go to set this stuff right. And then mentally and physically we clean up. And that means that our relationships on the outside, I don't think about it just physically as in like physical health. I look at it like my actual relationships on the outside and my internal condition on the inside happen. You know, sometimes it's about taking action. And it's not because I was given, it's not because, a lot of times it's because I'm given the grace to take that action, because based on my own will, I won't do it. You know? So when I'm talking about the A step, it says become willing to make amends to them all. So that means I have to stop being a victim in the A step. It means that the A step is no longer about what other people do to me. You know, it took me a long time to be willing to make amends to all the people who I believed I harmed and who I believed that harmed me. Still, on some level, I wanted other people to admit where they were wrong. I wanted to acknowledge that they had harmed me as much as I had harmed them, or if they didn't do it first, I wouldn't have had to do what I did. And, you know, and that's not really what the A step's all about. You know, it's about feeling... I want to see if I can articulate this. The one thing that's really hard about this is experiencing the steps and putting it into words are two very different things. And words fail sometimes, and actions or demeanor, atmosphere, sometimes says more than actually what words do. So when I'm talking about the A step and I'm saying that, that being willing to make amends to the people that I have harmed and no longer living in a place where I expect other people to adhere, to admit, I didn't need that anymore. I didn't need the people in my life that I believed harmed me or I harmed them to say that they were sorry or to admit that they were wrong. You know, for my entire life, I was always convinced that it was my fault or that what I believed happened wasn't real, because a lot of times it wasn't. And some of the stuff that was real, I needed people to admit in order to make me feel safe. And when that deep surrender happened within me, when it came to 6 and 7, I no longer needed other people to behave in a certain way so that I could feel safe. And it became easier for me to be willing to make amends to them all, because they weren't so threatening to me. Does that make sense to you? I never wanted to admit that I was wrong, because then you would know that I was fallible. And you would know that every little thing that I had ever done before or anybody had ever said that I did was true. And my life was so dependent, my self-worth was so dependent upon how other people saw me and protecting myself. You know, in the big book it talks about self-seeking. And it talks about self-centeredness and selfishness, and they're all different graduations of self. And I look at self-seeking as, you know, looking to cover my butt. I'm always looking to protect me. That everything in my life, every relationship I have, is about me. And if you threaten me, I'm going to cover my butt and protect myself from you. And usually, I cause harm in doing that. And that was a belief system, that was a thing that I could not bring into the 8th and 9th step, because it was about fitting myself to be of maximum service to God and others. And I couldn't do that if I was still afraid of you and what you might do to me. Or, you know, and I was afraid of pain too. I still am afraid of pain. And I don't like looking bad. And I don't like it when people don't treat me in the way that I think they should. You know, and the difference between not liking it and seeking to change everybody else in order to avoid it are two different things. I could not like something. It can downright annoy me. But today, because I've been living and working in 10, 11, and 12, and I've gone out and made 9-step amends, and I brought this spirit of the 8th step into my life, what other people think about me doesn't necessarily define who I am. What you say about me doesn't necessarily define who I believe I am. And how you treat me doesn't necessarily define what I think about myself. So I'm not as threatened, and it's okay. It is okay to be willing to make amends to people who I have harmed or who I believe have harmed me. Because if you harm me, I probably harmed you too. You know that whole 2-to-tango thing? And the time, you know, and you know that didn't happen to me. Like that, bringing that kind of attitude to the 8th and 9th step didn't happen to me until I made amends to my mother about the 50th time. You know, and I tell this story all the time because it's the most powerful example in my life of what God can do. You know, I spent a lot of my life hating my mother. I believe that she was the reason why I was so messed up. I didn't, you know, that whole thing about, you know, about outside circumstances not really having much to do with alcoholism wasn't something I wasn't totally buying into. I still was sure that I would have been an alcoholic, but I wouldn't have been so screwed up and tried to kill myself 9 times had she have been a better mother. But no, the truth was is that I endured a lot of physical and sexual abuse as a child. And I believe that in some level she could have prevented it. And I wasn't empathetic to where she was at because I was too busy being angry and feeling the victim. And, you know, when I started talking about the 8th step, I said, you can't bring the victim into the 8th step. The victim has to die before you get there. Because I went and I made amends to my mother. And I made amends to her before because I was always doing something. Every 4th step I had to go. It was like a yearly thing. It was really funny because it's a joke in the family because I'd go up to her and be like, you know, Mom, it's been a rough year. I did this, this, and this, and I'm really sorry, and I won't do it again. You know, what could I do to set it right? And she'd be like, just stop doing it. You know, and it was usually because I'd fight with her at least once or twice a year where I wouldn't speak to her for a couple weeks because she wasn't doing what I thought she was. Because I felt she was repeating the patterns of my childhood. Again, I was attached to what other people did to me and what they did to me to find whether I felt important or not. So I went and I made amends to her, and I had been working with my sponsor, Cass, and I had done this 5th step with her, and this was before the amazing, you know, 7-step spiritual experience. And I went and I made amends to my mom, you know, and Cass had talked to me. She was like, you know, somehow in having Cass, who was a mom, you know, and she had a daughter my age, listen to my 5th step and say, you know what, yeah, you know what, you had a really rough life. And then talk about how she would have felt if she was in the position of my mother and me to step for 5 minutes outside of that relationship and see my mother for who she was, which is a human being, not the Madonna, you know, that I expected her to be. Not Madonna, you know who I'm talking about, like that whole Michelangelo Madonna thing. Okay. The Pieta. I talked to Cass and I'd done this 5th step, and I went to my mom and I made amends. And for the first time in my life, I didn't expect her to say she was sorry. I didn't need it. Like, it was enough to know and to see the empathy and to be willing to give her that forgiveness of not demanding that amends that I thought I deserved from her. Because I thought that, you know, because the one thing that happens with physical and sexual abuse is nobody ever talks about it. And most people just pretend it doesn't happen. So the thing that pisses the abusee off more than anything else is the fact that it's ignored. You know, you get sent to therapy and everything, but nobody actually ever, like, articulates it. So that happened to me. And I was pissed. I was like, you know, you just say you were sorry, or, like, just say, you know, Kara, if I could have prevented it, I would. But nobody ever talked about it, and I slowly went insane and spiraled down in alcoholism, died 9 times, not kidding, died once. You know, spent a lot of time in the loony bin and cut my arms up a real lot and did all kinds of crazy stuff, you know, trying to make people admit that I had been hurt and no one would. And then I spent 5 years in sobriety being pissed that nobody did what I wanted them to do, which is just admit it. And I finally, I was like, you know, I've been pissed for 5 years of sobriety. I squandered all this time fighting my family because I want them to say they're sorry over something they didn't even do to me. Just because they didn't see me or couldn't prevent my spiral of pain, which would have happened because I'm an alcoholic anyway. So I brought that to the nine-step amends, and I made my amends to my mother, and she did something she had not done in 23 years, which is tell me that she was sorry that I had such a rough childhood. The one thing I always wanted. The one thing I went insane over and spent a lot of time in Carrier about and spent a lot of time on antidepressants and wrote Four Steps for 5 years. She said it because I didn't need it. That's where that whole thing about God reliance comes in. Just like, you know, I had that amazing practically white light spiritual experience when I didn't need it from God to validate whether or not my spirit was awake. When I stopped demanding from the world all the things I think I deserve, they happen. Because I rely on God instead of outside things to tell me that I'm okay. And after that, I went and made amends to my brother who had done a lot of that physical abuse. And to this day, he has yet to say he was sorry. And I don't need it. I don't need it. I love him anyway. I don't hate him. I love him. And so, on one level, I got the amends that I had always wanted. And another level, it hasn't even come. And it was funny because last summer, my sister and my brother got into an argument about me. They still argue about me. Because he said that I wasn't spending enough time with my kids because I was in school. And she said, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. Basically, she defended me saying about how great I'm doing in my life. Because apparently the consensus in my family is that I spend too much time in AA. I go to one AA meeting a week, sometimes two. But between school, kids, and AA, it's often a hard thing. I had a lot of sponsees, and he was right. I had 13 sponsees, full-time school, two kids, and I was going to an AA meeting a week or two. And he was absolutely 100% right. So he made this observation, and my sister went off on him, told him it was all his fault that I was screwed up anyway. And she told me about this argument. And I heard this argument, and this was 2 years after I had made amends to my brother. And I didn't need to call him up and tell him that he was wrong, defend myself in the least. And in fact, I told her that he was right. That, yeah, you know what? I haven't been spending enough time with my kids. And my life is unmanageable, and AA and 12 steps and all these other things have been taking too much of a forefront in my life. And this was the same person that I hated, and between him and my mother, I blamed for my descent into alcoholism and insanity. And I was able to defend him about me and my shortcomings. Not get a resentment, go to my sponsor and be like, well, it kind of annoys me that he said this because I don't like it when people talk about me. But when I saw him like a week or two later at my parents' house, I realized I was not angry. For me, that's amazing. I'm Irish, man. I'm angry about everything. You know, anger and sarcasm and, you know, cursing. those are just things that I like. And anger has been something that has slowly slipped away from me, you know. And when I saw him and I realized I wasn't angry, I realized that amends I had made 2 years ago to him, forgiving him. Because every time, don't you ever do this? Like whenever somebody who harmed you, you know, years back, you know, does something that was similar to what they did then, do you ever like bring out the list of all the horrible things they ever did to you? You know, say, this is a repetitive pattern of their abuse to me, and they should treat me better, and they should go to therapy, and these people, you know. I end up spending a lot of time in therapy because people, I believed other people needed therapy. The point was is that for me, every time somebody in my family did something to hurt me, it felt like it would touch that nerve of pain that went back from the time that I was 30 years old. And so whenever they did that, it was just a white hot poke. And the thing is that today in my family, they do the same stupid stuff they've always done. And I'm sure I do it to them. I don't feel that anymore. That nerve died. And it happened in a ninth step. Because I stopped wanting them to stop. And I stopped basing my worth on whether they love me. Because I know they do. You know, everybody on this earth loves everybody else on this earth because we all have God within us, and the God within us loves everybody. At least this is my belief. Of course, you know, we announced that at the beginning of this meeting, right? But the speaker's, you know, opinion is their opinion, not a reflection of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'll say whatever the hell I want. I believe that. Yeah, see? Checked it. I believe that. I believe that the most despicable people on the face of the earth, or what people are believed to be despicable, had love within them, and some part of them that they weren't in touch with loved every person on the face of this earth. Because I don't think that there's a being on the face of this earth that doesn't have God in them even just a little bit. And if there's God there, there's love there, because God, love and God to me are synonymous. So, you know, when I realized that people love me even though their actions didn't necessarily say so, then I didn't really need that outward expression. I mean, there are times when it annoys me that people don't do what I want, or people don't realize how special I am. You know, and they don't realize just what a wonderful person I am, and, you know, shouldn't they treat me better so they don't lose me? I mean, there are times, I mean, you have to, it's a big laugh. I bring this stuff to my sponsor, and she's just like, oh, you know, that whole outside, you know, people needing validation. I'm like, shut up, I know. I'm going to go home and deal with this, you know. But, you know, but the point is that I'm not telling you that I walk through this earth and I, you know, and the Red Sea parts wherever I go. That's not what I'm saying to you. What I'm saying to you is that as I spend a lot of time and a lot of pain in my life basing who I thought I was on who you thought I was and how you acted to me. You know, they say that people who are the perpetual victim, and by the way, you know, the big book kind of says that alcoholics are perpetual victims. I don't know if anybody ever read that whole, like, you know, 60-63, but it says that, you know, it says the alcoholic who's given it up, you know, gotten the efforts. You know, if that's not a victim, I don't know what is. You know, the point is that people in psychology, they say that people who have been victimized or believe that they're the victim have an uncanny ability to read other people's body language and voice inflection, because we spend all our time focusing on what other people are going to do to us, you know, and trying to control it. And I spent my entire life putting so much energy into that and being so afraid of the emotional pain that would happen when people hurt me, or I lost people, or they didn't like me anymore. You know, in the past year or so, there have been a lot of people who don't like me anymore who used to think I was great. And that's okay with me today. I feel safe today in a way that I've never felt safe in my life. And it stems from all the work that I've done up until this point. And it really stems from the things that I've been talking about tonight. I mean, all the work and all the things that I've talked about have really come to a head in 6 and 7, 8 and 9. I mean, for me, this is where the miracles happen. These are where the awakenings happen. You know, because in the 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening. So somewhere between 1 and 12, something's supposed to happen within us. And Carl Jung says that it's a rearrangement of our motives and belief systems. You know, and that's exactly what the spiritual awakening, or having had a spiritual awakening, is talking about. And so somewhere between 1 and 12, that happens. And for me, it happened in 6 and 7, 8 and 9. You know, I learned a lot about myself in 4 and 5. You know, and I didn't even understand the second and third step until I did this other stuff. To be honest, and I still don't understand them on some level. I mean, I think personally we should talk about 4 and 5 first. That's my opinion. I mean, I love it. There's some people who do big book workshops and they talk about 12 before they talk about anything else. You know, they talk about 12 step, carrying the message, working with the drunk. You know, because the truth is that the second and third step are so complex. And it seems like they're very simple, but the first step, too, it's so complex that the true meaning of what happens in those steps doesn't really come into focus until the latter steps, and it with time. You know, I talk about it a lot, that I came into AA because of my drinking, you know, and I come in here and I do the steps because I don't want to die. Something happened in between wanting to work the steps because I didn't want to die and then wanting to work the steps because I wanted to feel superior to all the people who didn't. And then coming to a place, I'm being honest here, you know, the other amazing thing about 6, 7, 8, and 9 is that there's very few things that I won't say from the podium. Well, and, you know, not everybody appreciates that. But the fact is that I don't really have a lot to hide. I don't. You know, I've done some pretty demented things in my life. I've fallen short in 1,000 different ways, and I share them freely because they're no longer a source of shame for me. You know, when my relationships stopped being about me, they stopped being about shame because they weren't a reflection of me and who I was. You know, what? Oh, okay. Anyway, so I totally forgot what I was saying. Mike distracted me with those stupid mints or something. I don't know what the heck he was doing. No, that's okay. I don't know. What more can I say about the 8 and 9 step that I haven't said? All right, here's something I'll cop to. There's not much that I won't share from the podium. I'm balking on 2 amends. I'm balking. Like, I don't want to do them. The 2 amends, they're not even big amends, but they're people in AA, and I really hate making amends to people in AA. I so hate it. It's so much easier crawling to my family because they've seen my warts. They've seen every horrible thing I've ever done since the day I was born. And they already know what to expect from me, but somehow going to people in AA who are supposed to see, like, me be a better person, and I'm supposed to be all spiritual here and stuff, you know, and then I have to go make an amends. I don't like doing that. I don't want to do it. And I'm balking. Except for I sent an email to somebody today because I wasn't sure if I could reach him by phone in order to make arrangements to make amends to him. Because it's not about me. You know, I spent so much time having my relationships be about myself that I caused so much harm. You know, and I said this last week that fear, and the big book says that it's classed with stealing because fear steals. Because fear causes us to do things that we wouldn't normally do, and it steals the security from other people in our lives. And part about the thing about the 9 step, it is for me, is that it's my opportunity to give that security back to other people. And it's not me who's doing it, but God working through me. Because I'm slowly becoming somebody different. Somebody who doesn't do those things. Somebody who, in doing the 9 step, a lot of the fear that I had and a lot of the guilt that I carried around and that little... I was so afraid of morphing back into that person that I was before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous or before I went through the steps, that any time that she reared her ugly little head, I would become terrified. I'd be convinced that everything that I'd done into AA and all the person that I'd become was just an illusion, and that I was really, truly that person who was sick, who was hurtful, who did things that that hurt other people. You know, going to make those amends slowly, slowly removes that from me. So that I become somebody who is less ruled by fear, therefore less likely to do the things that I've done in the past. And doesn't mean I don't repeat the same mistakes, because I do. But I've said before that I think that the program and life is cyclical, you know, and that it goes in a cycle. And so I'm slowly, you know, we talk about the epicenter, like think about it like kind of a nuclear bomb that's carrying and drinking. And as I grow spiritually, I slowly move away from that. And sometimes the patterns repeat themselves, but often they don't have the intensity. They don't have, I bring an awakened spirit to these circumstances. And so then my outside circumstances don't always dictate my inner climate. Therefore, I'm able to be graced with the opportunity to be in these circumstances without causing harm to others, or not a lot of harm, or the amount of harm that I used to cause. So in going to make the amends, you know, not only am I just setting right the harms that I caused to that specific person, but I'm allowing that awakened spirit to come through so that I'm no longer capable of doing what I did before. You know, because I used to say all the time, you know, I'm sorry, I won't do it again, and I would. And no one believed me after a certain point until I became somebody who wouldn't do it again. Till I was no longer in the grips of fear to the extent that I was so that I would do that. So I'm actually going to make those amends, and that's going to be fun. I'm actually really looking forward to the freedom that I get from it. You know, one of the most difficult, and I'll end with this, one of the most difficult amends that I've ever had to make was to CVS and Pathmark. I was one of those people. Like, I just, you know, I'd shove my pockets full of whatever I could, you know, and NyQuil had alcohol in it if you didn't have money, which I didn't a lot because my parents, you know, had went to Al-Anon, and I had to steal a lot, and, you know, I had to do what I had to do to do what I had to do. So I had to go back to CVS and Pathmark in my hometown, which I was living in at that time, that I shopped at, and make amends and pay them their money back. And I don't want to do that. And I had to go back to my old high school, too, with a letter of amends to the staff and the teachers and talk to the principal and make amends for the harms that I caused because I used to set fires and stuff. Yeah. I didn't understand why I kept getting suspended for that. I just set a fire. And I had to go back with a letter and make amends for that stuff. And those were, like, the hardest ones to do because they were people who didn't know me. And there were people that I wanted to appear to be the suburban soccer mom to. And I'd go in there and be like, you know, I'm in this 12-step fellowship, and I need to make amends for the harms that I've caused, and this is what I did, and what can I do about it? It was such a humbling thing to do. And I didn't want to do it. And I was challenged to do it, you know. A lot of times, the people who, up until a certain point in my life, the people who wanted to get me to do something had to appeal to my ego in order for God to come in. And do his job, because I wasn't going to do it unless you challenged me to do it. And it'd be like, well, oh yeah? Well, you know, the big boys do this. I'm like, well, I'll do it too then. Prove that I'm tough as you. So I went and I made this amends to CVS and a Pathmark. And I paid my $30 or $60 or whatever it was, and 2,000 managers had to come over. It was really fun. I'd walk up to the thing and be like, can I please speak to the manager? And like, what about? And I'm like, well, I'm a member of a 12-step program, blah, 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 blah. And they'd be like, hold on, let me go get the other manager. And so the other manager, I'd come talk to him. He'd be like, no, you have to talk to so-and-so. So but the third manager who came over to listen to my spiel about me being a drunk, everybody at the store knew. And I shop there. And you know what? I make it a point to go there now. I still do it. I wouldn't not go there anymore. So I went, and I paid my money, and I walked out of that store, and I went to Pathmark, and it did the same thing, and I walked out, and I realized that I could make any amends that I needed to make, that I could probably meet any person on the street today, and I have, that I've harmed, and I was willing to make amends to them all, right then and there. If I had to, because I had faced the anonymous clerk at Pathmark, at CVS, and my evil principal at my high school, who remembered the day that I was born because my older sister was in his homeroom, and every time I would get in trouble and I get sent to the principal Orsini's office in Bloomfield High School, he would sit down and say, your sister Maureen is so smart and beautiful. And she used to be in my homeroom class. She was my favorite student. Didn't you know that? And I remember the day you were born. And look at you here with your, you know, sticking up green hair and knives and you're fighting and setting things on fire. What is the matter with you? Why aren't you like your sister is what I heard. And to go back there and to be willing to make those amends, it was really hard. Bloomfield High School loomed over me. I didn't want to step foot in that place again. But I did it. And those amends were the amends that gave me the feeling that I could make any amends I needed to make. They gave me the freedom of the eighth step. So sometimes by actually knocking on the door and going to make the amends, the spirit of the eighth step comes to you. a lot of times that's kind of how it works. You work the ladder step, you put in the action, and the spirit of the step previous to it happens. And it's not through your willing it to happen, but because it's a natural consequence of being willing to align your will with God's. And thank you for letting me share.